First of all, welcome. My name is Michael Thompson. I am general counsel for the Church of the Nazarene. I am an attorney, also an ordained elder. So if you needed some entertainment after lunch, you needed to see the freak show, here I am. There. You know that about 25% of all Christian attorneys are here in this room right now. So.
Saying three others?
and they are, there's a question about them. So. I did put up here, if you're able to see it, I put my name and my email address. You may want to jot that down. If you have any questions relating to anything that I talk about today, or if issues come up later on unrelated to what I'm talking about, and you would just like to reach out and see if we have any resources or advice for you, feel free to contact me. I'll give you right now the disclaimer that I would probably be telling you when you get a hold of me, and that is I can't actually serve as your attorney. Depending on what state you're from, I may not even be licensed to practice law in that state. But what I can do is give you some general guidance on the way that other churches have handled these things. I can talk to you from a U.S. federal law standpoint on several things relating to religious liberties and nonprofit law. And if nothing else, I can try to get you connected with somebody who can help you. So feel free to take down that information. I want you to imagine for a moment that you're sitting in the airport and you're about to get on your plane. You're flying off somewhere and you hear this announcement come over the PA system that the Department of Homeland Security is raising the terror alert. That they have reason to believe that there may be an act of terror related to aviation. And you are to report anybody who appears suspicious or any activity that appears suspicious. What are some of the things you're going to be looking for? Well, right away, we have a concept in our minds of what suspicious activity in an airport looks like. I mean, it's going to be somebody who is looking around nervously. Somebody who appears to be sweating profusely for no apparent reason. People who wear great big jackets, even in the middle of summer. People who have a lot of luggage and then go around and put it all over the place and then leave. That's the sort of thing that we'd be looking for, and we would probably be correct if we were looking for suspicious activity in an airport. Now suppose that you're not in the airport. Suppose you're at your home. And you hear that there is a credible threat of sexual abuse that will be committed against a child that you know sometime in the next week. What are some of the suspicious characters or activities or places that you would that you'd be identifying where you would want to protect the children you love? If you're like most people, the image that immediately comes to mind of the suspicious character, the child abuser, is probably going to be some creepy-looking guy who looks remarkably like my Uncle Harold. he is wearing a trench coat. He's just, I mean, you look at him and you get shivers up your spine. He's the kind of person you wouldn't allow within a half mile of any child. You would probably be thinking that it's the person who's driving around in the white van without any windows, the one who calls children over and says, "Hey, my puppy is missing. Will you come with me and help find the puppy?" Now, there are certainly some who do that sort of thing. But if that's what your primary concept is of the people who have designs against our children, if that's your picture, you are missing 99% of them. If the place that you would probably put your children in order to keep them safe is going to be just with people that you know and trust, if it's probably going to be at your church or at a community center or someplace like that, well, despite your best intentions, you have probably just placed your child in the place that is most likely to attract the ones that have designs upon the children. When I talk to you about the number one pitfalls, the number one legal issues that face churches, this one, this issue of child protection is number one, and it has been every single time that I have presented this workshop. it continues to be the biggest area that churches, ministries, pastors, church leaders face. Let me tell you some sobering facts relating to child protection. Studies tell us that 1 out of 5 Americans have been sexually abused. Now, the definition of sexual abuse here is forcing undesired sexual behavior on someone else. It doesn't have to be physical contact. It can be sexually related, sexually explicit text messaging, social media, phone calls, conversations, showing pictures, but 1 out of 5. 1 out of 3 girls, 1 out of 6 boys will be sexually abused before the age of 18. 66% of the victims will not talk about this until they are adults, if ever. There's 657,000 registered sex offenders in the United States, but that is not the primary group that we are protecting against, because the average sex offender whose preference is boys will molest 150 boys before being caught. If his preference is molesting girls, the offender will molest 52 victims before being caught. The average offender begins molesting at age 13 and will not be convicted until 35. Less than 10% of those who will commit acts of abuse against our children, less than 10%, have ever had contact with the criminal justice system. This is important to remember, because if your primary way that you are protecting children within your church is by doing background checks, you have to do background checks, but if that's the primary thing that you're doing, I want you to keep in mind that you are only catching, at best, 10% of those who have designs upon our children. So 9 out of 10 are going to slip right through the system if that is your only protection within your church. 90% of the victims are abused by somebody they know and trust. And in the past 5 years, we've seen a 300% increase of the abuse of peer-to-peer. That means children abusing children. So, I ask you again, who comes to mind when you think of those that have designs against our children? Our stereotypical concept of the people who are going to be most risky, that concept is wrong. There's two types of child abusers. There is the psychopathic abuser. That is the guy in the trench coat and the van without the windows. That is the one who is going to be going around and picking children at random that he's never seen before. And you do have to be on guard against that. We don't want anybody doing that sort of thing. But 99% will be people who are known and trusted, not just by the children, but by the parents. Because if you have children, or if you have grandchildren, you know that before anybody gets anywhere close to your children or grandchildren, what do they have to do? They have to get past you. So, the number one technique that child abusers will use is to present themselves as being helpful, trustworthy, and kind. They are going to ingratiate themselves first with the parents. And then once they have the trust of the parents, then they are going to prey upon the children. These are some of the techniques that child abusers use. First, they have to get past the parents as the gatekeepers. They will then put themselves in a position to be able to observe and interact with children. And then they start looking for those who are on the fringes, those that are kind of outsiders, the ones that don't really have a strong peer network. They're going to start preying on them. They're going to be looking for them and moving in and ingratiating themselves with them. Now, if you're in ministry, particularly if you're in children and youth ministry, so far, I've described you. Because what do? As a youth pastor, as a children's pastor, as a Sunday school teacher, you want to be looking for those who are out on the fringes. You want to be looking for those who are being ostracized, those who are at most at risk. And you're going to go in and you want them to trust you. You want them to be able to respond to you, and you want to be able to communicate well with them. So far, I've just described the perp, the predator, and I've described a good youth worker. Here's where it differs. Because once they get into that position, a youth worker is going to be using his or her influence to try to bring that person into the community and into the life of the church. The predator is going to use their influence to isolate that person and take them away. They'll take them away, and they will use techniques such as secrecy, shaming. They will use techniques of trying to test the boundaries, push the boundaries to find what the children's comfort level is with nudity, with sexual talk. They will capitalize upon anyone who already has a history of breaking the law, so they look for those who like to smoke and drink and break curfew and get in trouble, because they can just build upon that. So that's the point at which the predator differs from any person who would normally be involved in children's work. I mention these things because when we talk about developing a safe system for our churches, so we're not falling prey to these problems, what we need to be doing is have a system that identifies these grooming techniques and make sure that they are not happening. I get far too many calls from pastors, from church leaders, who have just discovered that something has happened, that something has happened to a child within the church. Only once have I ever heard them say, "And we knew that this was coming. We knew that this guy was a creep." Every other time, without fail, it has been, "We didn't see this coming because this is Uncle Joe. Everybody loves Uncle Joe. I mean, the kids love him. Parents love him. He looks so nice, so grandfatherly." Well, of course he looks that way, because if he looked like a creep, he wouldn't have been allowed near the children in the first place. And far too often when I talk to churches, when I talk to ministry leaders about the importance of establishing a good child protection program, what I hear back is, we're good, because we already know everybody. We're a small enough church that we know everyone, we trust everyone, nobody has any secrets. That's the sort of thing that the child predator, that's the sort of place that he or she is going to move to and seek out. They will go to where the resistance is the lowest. They will go to a place where that sort of atmosphere is invited. So when I talk to church leaders, what I have been asking them for the longest time is, have you yet done the Nazarene Safe training? And I got a lot of people that said, yes, we've done it. I've since learned that they think they've done it, but they haven't. Here's what a lot of people think it means to do Nazarene Safe child protection. We do background checks. Period. They think that's sufficient. Well, as I've already said, that's not. That doesn't even begin to cover it. Or they say, we are Nazarene Safe because we have a two-adult rule, which is good. We have a rule that there will always be two adults present whenever there are children. But then I ask the next question, how often do you follow that? You've got this policy. Does that policy belong in the fiction section or the nonfiction section of your library? You see, I've been around churches long enough to know that we have lots of policies. And church boards will talk about policies, and they will adopt policies, and then they will forget about them. And so one question I would ask for all of you is, how many of you know right now where all the policies are for your church? Would you be able to put your hands on them? And if you do, are those policies being followed? If your church board has actually adopted a policy that says we're always going to have two adults in every room, does that happen? Or does that happen when there are two adults available? If you have a policy that says everybody's going to have a background check before they can work with children, is that actually followed, or is it only followed if there are available adults who have had background checks? You see, as a general rule, you're better off having no policy than have a policy that you don't follow. Because if there is a problem in your church, somebody like me, actually not somebody like me, it will be a lawyer who is totally unsympathetic to what you believe, is going to have you on the witness stand and will say, now, let me show you Plaintiff's Exhibit A. This is a copy of the policy your church adopted for the protection of children. You're familiar with this, aren't you? Your church adopted this because you believe it's important to protect children. So important that you had to make it a matter of policy. Let me ask you, was this policy being followed? Well, it wasn't. So you've acknowledged that you did this in order to protect children, but you've ignored it. Fact is, children don't matter to you, do they? And long before defense counsel is going to be able to object, plaintiff's attorney is going to be pounding the table, telling the jury what low, rotten scumbags you all are, because you don't care enough about children to even take a look at the policy manual from time to time. Now, don't take away from this the fact, the suggestion that we go and get rid of all our policies. Not what I'm suggesting. What I am saying is that we do need to take time to review what our policies are. Find out if they really work. If they don't, then let's find something that does. I mentioned I'm, in addition to being a lawyer, I'm also an elder. So I'm going to take off my lawyer's hat for a moment and put on the pastor's hat. Actually, I'm going to wear them both at the same time. Because before I got called into ministry, I was a prosecutor. And I handled every kind of case from barking dogs to first-degree murder. And I've seen some horrible things. Blessedly, once I finished with those issues, the Lord has wiped the worst details from most of those cases from my mind. I don't dwell on them. With one exception, I can see the face of every child victim in every case that I ever handled. I can tell you every single detail about those cases. And so when I talk to you about child protection issues, I am talking as a lawyer, and I'm also talking as a pastor. Primarily, I'm talking to you as father of four boys. Here is a secret of how to avoid liability issues. Don't let the harm happen in the first place. These policies that we develop are not just to meet some sort of legal requirement, they're to actually accomplish the task of keeping our children safe. When we do that, it's going to be remarkable how infrequently we get sued. When nobody gets hurt, people generally don't have a grief. I hear a lot of churches say, well, you know, we would do this, what you're talking about, but it's so expensive. And we're a small church. We have to choose sometimes whether we can pay the light bill or pay the pastor. We don't have a lot of extra money. And believe me, I understand it. But let me just tell you a little bit about how this all works. First of all, if you choose to do a child protection training program for your church through Nazarene Safe, we actually use our ministry partner, Ministry Safe. They have a special deal set up where you can do all the training online. The cost is $100 per church per year, and then $5 per person who successfully completes the online training. It takes about 45 minutes to do it. So it's not a huge expense. But even if that expense is causing you some difficulty, let me ask you this question. Suppose somebody came to you and said, I have this great idea for a ministry for our church. See, I've looked around and I see that there are a lot of people in this community who need brain surgery, but they can't afford it. We can provide the brain surgery to people. They'll come here to the church, and we'll do it here. We've got YouTube videos instructing volunteers on how they can do it. It'll be good. Well, anybody in a position of leadership within the church would say, you know, your heart's in the right place, but we are not equipped to do that well. And because we're not equipped to do that well, we are not going to do that. Yeah, it makes sense, right? You know, there is no more precious resource with which we are trusted than our children? There's none. Why would we ever take the position that we're going to do children's ministry even though we can't do it well? The fact of the matter is, if we can't devote to them that which they need, we shouldn't be doing it in the first place. And I haven't even gotten to the fact that it will cost you millions if there is a problem. So, on that note, I strongly encourage everyone, if they have not yet done so, to go back to their churches and get Nazarene Safe. You can go to NazareneSafe.org or you can go to MinistrySafe.com. You can sign up. You can get that training done, and you will not regret it. A related area is this is actually becoming the number one liability issue for churches around the country. It's in the issue in the area of sexual misconduct against children, but not necessarily where misconduct has occurred by a church member or on church premises. It happens at the home, at the school, somewhere. And then somebody within the church hears about it. The child may say something to a Sunday school teacher, may say something to a friend, and a Sunday school teacher or a pastor or somebody overhears it, whatever it may be. This is the biggest area of liability right now in failure to report this immediately to the proper authorities. It is the law of the land in all states relating to who has to report incidents of suspicions of sexual misconduct, any kind of abuse against a child. And it's getting more and more uniform across the country, but there are variations. And so if you live in Kansas, it is there's one standard of who has to report. If you live in Missouri, there's another standard. In Illinois, it's another. Fortunately, as Nazarenes, life has been made so easy. You know who has to report suspicions of misconduct against a child? You do. Every one of us. If you are in a position of leadership or ministry or service within the Church of the Nazarene, you have an obligation to report. I want you to hear what I did not say. I did not say you have an obligation to go and investigate. Right. You do not. You have an obligation to report. I did not say you have an obligation to report those incidents that have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The standard is you have an obligation to report a reasonable suspicion that a child has been or could be hurt. Now, Fred.
What's your definition of reasonable?
Well, I can give you a definition of reasonable. This is I'm going to go into lawyer weasel talk here, because ultimately the ones who will define reasonable will be 12 jurors deciding whether you did enough. Reasonable is what any reasonably prudent person is what the law says. A reasonably prudent person is my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law, Wanda. If she suspects that something is going on with her grandchildren, that sweet woman will level communities in order to do anything that she can to protect them. She is not going to hear some sort of talk about something happening to her grandchildren and think, that's curious. I'll talk to somebody about that next week when I get around to it. Or I'm going to go investigate. No, she would immediately respond, because she doesn't want there to be the possibility of something happening. I could tell you unreasonable would be something that's just so totally off the wall. I've gotten weird calls in the last week, so I'm trying to figure out which ones would be the most. But I had at least one person concerned about aliens influencing their behavior. That's probably an unreasonable thing if somebody says that aliens did something. But who knows? Maybe they did. My theory is, when in doubt, report it. Now, the law says that you can report to local law enforcement, or you can report to the 800 number that each state has set up. You can go to childwelfare.gov if you want to know specifics for your jurisdiction. My recommendation is whenever you would report, you would call the 800 number, and here's why. You are probably, it's going to be very, very rare that you would ever hear a report of something that's just obviously, blatantly a case of child abuse. You're probably going to hear something more along the lines of 18-year-old boyfriend had sex with a 16-year-old girlfriend, and it was consensual, and the parents knew about it, and everybody was okay with it. And is that child abuse or not? If you call local law enforcement, in my experience, you're going to get one of two reactions. You're either going to have somebody who says, eh, and they won't pay any attention, or they're going to come in with red and blue lights and arrest everybody in the middle of the day, simply because they don't deal with these situations enough to be able to know how to deal with the more nuanced things. But when you call that 800 number, they deal with these things all the time. They'll handle it appropriately. You can call it in anonymously if you want. If you do call it in anonymously, I'd ask, whether you give your name or not, be sure you get a case number so that you can prove that you did what you were supposed to do by reporting. You need to call with as soon as there is a reasonable suspicion. All you have to do is do a little bit of searching online, and you're going to find case after case after case of churches where this has been handled wrong. The reports come in. It will be reported up to a Sunday school teacher who will tell the pastor about it next time he or she sees the pastor. The pastor will then investigate it or appoint the youth pastor to go and investigate, and they'll kick it around for a while before finally deciding what to do. And if that's what your approach is, you can be like a church recently in Texas, not one of ours, but a church recently in Texas that had some wonderful free publicity when the pastor, youth pastor, Sunday school superintendent, and a few teachers had their mugshots on the front page because all of them were arrested. I believe they waited 8 days before reporting it. They did report, but they didn't report in a timely manner. So the moment you have a reasonable suspicion, report it. Call it in. Any questions on that?
In India, we call it juvenile justice. Mm-hmm. And in America, what do we call it?
We have different levels of the court system. Usually there's something similar. It'd be the juvenile division of the court that would handle those. Mm-hmm. All right, another...
you're saying in regard to the reasonable time, so the day you hear of it, you should report it. That would be a reasonable...
Yeah. I get calls on a regular basis and from people all over the country, and my first question is always, have you reported this? If they haven't, I tell them that that is the first thing they're going to do as soon as they get off the phone with me. There really is no reason to wait. Now, the law doesn't require this, but I strongly recommend that if you are not the pastor and you've reported this, that you tell your pastor right away. Pastor should know what's going on. And every pastor should immediately let his or her district superintendent know. Never let your DS be surprised by these things. And your DS has lived through more of these than he would like. So regardless of what district you're on, let your DS know, and you'll be able to get some good counsel at that point. I have a tendency to exaggerate sometimes, and I'm not here. This is literally the case. It's about every week I will get a call from somebody, and it always starts off this way. We have just discovered that there is this person who's attending our church, and what first drew our attention to him is that he is creepy. He just makes people uncomfortable. He's weird. Anybody got any of those in your church? And we have done some checking, and we discovered that he is a registered sex offender. And then the conversation goes one of two ways. It's either, what do we have to do in order to ban him from ever setting foot on church premises again? Or, we believe strongly in redemption and grace, so we are appointing him as our children's church director. Will you bless that? Very rarely does it get anywhere in between. Let me talk a bit about sex offenders in church. First of all, there is nothing in the manual, there's nothing in the law that says that a sex offender may not attend a church. And I would hope that all of them are. Now, everybody needs boundaries in their lives. I don't care what your background is. All of us need boundaries. All of us need accountability. It so happens that with some of us, because of decisions we have made, it's more readily apparent what some of those boundaries and some of that accountability needs to be. So if you have a sex offender who is going to be in your church, it is very appropriate to address with him or her right up front what those boundaries are going to look like. It's very appropriate to come up with a some sort of a written agreement, a covenant, and if you're looking for a template, feel free to write to me and just ask for a sex offender covenant, and I'll send you something that I've put together. But it would outline with that person the times that he or she can be in the building, the people with whom he or she has to be around, places he or she cannot go, that sort of thing. That would be a good thing to do. However, being there as part of the church, attending the church, is different from serving in the church. And by provision of our manual, paragraph 538.9, and a host of rulings from the Board of General Superintendents that have backed this up, a person who has a history of sexual misconduct with a minor, regardless of whether they have been in the criminal justice system, it doesn't matter whether they've been convicted. The question is, have they committed an act of sexual misconduct with a minor? It doesn't matter if it has been expunged. It doesn't matter if it doesn't matter how many years. A person who has committed an act of sexual misconduct with a minor may not be in any position of leadership, trust, or service within the Church of the Nazarene. General superintendents have backed that up with a ruling which says, it even goes to the point of saying, which means they may serve only as parishioners with no other duties or responsibilities. And despite this, I still get questions that come back and I get a lot of resistance from it. And I understand a lot of the resistance because we absolutely believe in the power of the Holy Spirit to cleanse the human heart, to change people, to turn them around. And it can be uncomfortable to say to somebody that because of this particular offense, you can't be doing anything in the church. So I understand that. But let me tell you how this is going to come back and most likely haunt you in your context. Let's say that you've got Uncle Joe. Uncle Joe's registered sex offender. Happened 20 years ago. He has since come to know the Lord. He's lived a transformed life. He wants to be involved there at your church. You take the appropriate steps because obviously you don't want to put him in there in contact with children for his protection and for the children's protection and the church's protection. So you give him some other ministry and you put him in the sound booth. Sound booth is where they, more often than not, is where I hear that this is where they end up serving. But you put him in the sound booth. And it turns out Uncle Joe is never a problem for you. He lives the rest of his life, no problem. But one of those people that you knew nothing about came in under the radar, and despite your best efforts, there's an incident in your church where a child is hurt. Had nothing to do with Uncle Joe. Had to do with Paul the perp. And there's a lawsuit that happens. And as pastor, you're put on the witness stand, and you're asked about Uncle Joe, and you say, but Uncle Joe didn't do anything. No. Let me ask you, Uncle Joe, you've had him serving there in the sound booth all this time, right? And you knew that he was a registered sex offender, right? And you're aware that manual paragraph 538.9 and 903.3 and Board of General Superintendent's rulings say that the Uncle Joe can't be there, right? And yet you've let him serve. The fact is, this church, you as pastor and this church board and the church as a whole believes it's above the law, doesn't it? In fact, you think that this book here means nothing. You can pick and choose what you want to do out of this. Since you can pick and choose, you choose the things that are important to you. Children obviously aren't important to this church, are they? And that's where you could get hurt. But let me tell you where it could also happen. Uncle Joe is serving here at your church. Over here in your church, somebody flies in under the radar. Despite your best efforts, a child is hurt. Your church is going to be sued. Your church, not yet. The district is going to be sued. The denomination will be sued. The district superintendent is going to be on the witness stand. And the district superintendent's immediately, when he's questioned about Uncle Joe over here in this church, the district superintendent says, well, you see, under our structure of government, the manual says that I can't get involved in the day-to-day operations of a local church. That's a local church matter. I can't do anything about that. And the plaintiff's attorney will say, ah, but you had the ability to take the credentials of the pastor who was thumbing his nose at the manual, and you chose to do nothing. Fact is, this district doesn't care about children. This district is only going to be motivated by the things that are important to it. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, how do you think we can get the attention of this district and let them believe that children are important? And the only thing a jury can do is start adding zeros to the end of that judgment. Your church had nothing to do with Uncle Joe. Your church pays the price. The district pays the price. All of us do. So it's very easy for me as a pastor to make a decision about something that's going on and say, well, I'm aware of the situation here. I've got it under control. I'm confident that it's not going to be a problem. But when, this book can be your best friend. I've never seen anybody get in trouble yet when they follow the provisions of the manual. But when you thumb your nose at it, then it stops being your best friend and it'll come back and haunt you. So this is where all of us, as a body of believers, can support one another and keep each other out of trouble. I just traveled to another district not too long ago to have this conversation with a church board to help them understand the consequences of this. Any questions on that?
Michael, tell us about scout troops.
Good question, and let me make sure that I cover that, because that'll blend well into this next topic, and that is with a decision almost exactly a year ago from the Supreme Court on same-sex marriage. A lot of questions have come up about what the liability of churches is, what's the liability of pastors relating to same-sex marriage, and our doctrinal position on the sanctity of marriage. Let me first tell you that there's no reason to be running in fear and panic because of that Supreme Court decision. It did not, despite what you may have heard, it did not criminalize a pastor's decision not to officiate at a wedding. It didn't address that issue at all. And yet, I've been getting calls from pastors saying, I'm going to go to jail if I won't perform a wedding for a same-sex couple. What? No, that's not the issue. Fact is that it is still the law of the land that a pastor has the authority to exercise his or her sacerdotal responsibilities according to the guidance of the Holy Spirit. Manual says that a pastor may only solemnize marriage where there is a biblical basis in marriage and where there has been careful counseling. But if you as a pastor have a couple that comes to you, and they have a biblical basis for marriage. It's one man and one woman. They've had careful counseling. There's nothing you could really put your finger on that why you shouldn't do this, but you're still getting this niggling from the Holy Spirit that says, I don't think so. You get to exercise your discretion and say, sorry, I can't perform this, and you're okay. I would advise you not to say hateful things in the process, saying, I'm not going to do this because you are all of you beneath me, you unworthy cretin. No. Just say, no, I'm not the one to do this. Supreme Court didn't touch that. Now, and they didn't deal specifically with this issue of what about the use of your facilities, but it kind of leads towards this. Your church may have issues relating to what you allow your building to be used for. If your building, if your facilities are available to people outside of your church for weddings, receptions, birthday parties, anniversaries, scout troops, and you start picking and choosing who you're going to allow to use the building for no particular reason, you're setting yourself up for a lawsuit for a discrimination claim. So here's how you have to address this. The courts will come in and you'll get in big trouble if you start saying, we don't let gay people use our building. And that's all you're saying. I mean, that's discriminatory. However, the courts are loath to tell a church that it is wrong in how it interprets its religious obligations and its acts of worship. So if you have a policy that addresses the use of your facilities, and your policy says that everything that is done in and through your church is part of your act of worship, and your religious obedience as you understand the interpretation, your interpretation of the Holy Scripture, and if you even back it up with some scriptural reference, thus far, the courts in this country have not been willing to come in and say, you interpreted the Bible wrong. So, your policy ought to say something along these lines. Our facilities, the use of our facilities is an expression of our act of worship and our religious obedience as we understand the Scripture. Everything that we do in our building, through our building, is in furtherance of our religious principles and our strategic reason for being here in this community. Now, remember what I said earlier about policies having to be in the nonfiction section instead of the fiction section? Here's where the scout troop thing comes in. Because let's say that you have made that statement. Building can only be used for religious purposes, for the furtherance of your purposes there in the community. And you let Boy Scouts come in. Why? Because they want to. Why? Because we have the space available. Yeah, it's not a super good reason. Because then, if a couple come in, a same-sex couple, and they want to rent your facilities for a wedding, and you say, nope, can't do that, sorry, you've got trouble. Because you have just arbitrarily, apparently to the court, arbitrarily said yes to one non-church organization and no to somebody else. Does that mean you can't have the Boy Scouts? Well, if you should ask the question with the Boy Scouts or with anybody who wants to do something in your church, why are we doing this? What's our purpose? If the purpose is to simply give them a place to meet, that's probably not going to be enough. But if as pastor, I can say, you know what? I believe that our church was raised up here for a reason. Part of that reason was to reach the families in this community. And the Boy Scouts give us access to families that are not a part of any church anywhere. Now, we're not going to let them just come and use our facilities, but we are going to strategically try to integrate them into the life of the church. And we're going to have people from our church get involved with the scouts. We're going to be inviting the scouts to come in. We're going to have intentional contact with family. Yeah, this fits with the vision God has given me for why this church is here. If you can articulate that, you're probably pretty good there. So that if you've allowed the Boy Scouts in on that basis, but then somebody comes in and they say, we want to use your facilities for a same-sex wedding, you can say, I'm sorry, that is absolutely out of harmony with our expression of worship and religious obedience as we understand the scripture. And we have to say no. Does that mean they won't sue you? You're probably going to get sued. But you will be far more likely to win. So I mentioned that with the Boy Scouts. You really ought to be asking that question of every activity that's taking place in your church. If you open up your churches to as a polling place so that on election day people come in and vote, is that part of our expression of worship and religious obedience, having federal or state government come into our churches? On its face, probably not. But if, as pastor, I could say, you know what? This actually gives us access to people that we otherwise wouldn't have access to. And while I'm not going to be allowed to go and proselytize on election day, I'm definitely going to be having interaction with some people over at the county clerk's office or whatever. And those are going to be some intentional conversations where I'm going to be building up relationships so that we can get more inroads into the community. If I can articulate that, I'm probably in pretty good shape. But if I'm put on the witness stand and I, as pastor, am asked, why'd you let them come in as a polling place? And I just start stuttering and I say, because we always did. It's not going to work. You're going to get clobbered. So in terms of your liability, aside from the same-sex marriage issue, whenever you have an outside organization come in, it's always prudent to make sure that your insurance company is aware of their coming in and the type of activities they're going to do. Ideally, I would like to make sure that the outside organization has sufficient insurance, specifically naming the church, and should always have a written agreement so that well, everybody is on good speaking terms, come up with the agreement about what it's going to look like when you're not on speaking terms anymore. So it's very clear who has responsibility to lock the doors, who has responsibility to clean up. Those are always good to have those things in writing.
Should we be requiring them to do background check?
The Boy Scouts already do. They do a phenomenal child protection program. They were forced into it because they got clobbered with some pretty big lawsuits, but their training is outstanding. Now, if they don't follow their policies and they have a problem, then they're going to sue. The Boy Scouts are also going to sue your church. I think the Boy Scouts cover every church with, I just saw it, it's something like $1.5 million. It's a nice rider. So if you ask them, they'll provide that for you. But you're pretty good shape there. Other questions?
Let me ask a question. If, say, you share a church with somebody else, and is they part of responsibility
to? Mm-hmm. A church is going to be responsible for everything that happens on its facilities to some degree. So if you're sharing it with another congregation, another organization, or something like that, always a good idea to make sure that they have adequate insurance coverage. Make sure, again, that you talk to your insurance provider so that they're aware of what's going on and that you have adequate insurance. And along that subject of insurance, I encourage every church, first of all, every year you should have a conversation with your insurance provider to make sure that they are aware of everything that's going on in your church. Because, sometimes you start up a food pantry, daycare, whatever, acquire a 15-passenger van, which is a liability nightmare. Make sure that they're aware of those things so that you have adequate coverage. Also, please, 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 double check what your coverage is for sexual misconduct against minors. There are only 3 or 4 insurance companies that protect, that will provide coverage for churches for sexual misconduct with minors. And what I've seen far too many times is a church will get a certain insurance package because a member of the church board or somebody connected with the church sells insurance or knows somebody who sells insurance, and so they can get a good deal. And that's good. I commend that. But while that's appropriate for hazard insurance, workers' comp, things of that sort, unless it's Philadelphia, Brotherhood, Church Mutual, or Guide One, you probably do not have true sexual misconduct protection. I've seen them where, with the other companies, where it will say, yes, sexual misconduct coverage, but then you read the fine print and it says up to $6,000. Well, $6,000 isn't going to cover you 1 week's worth of attorney's fees for that. Or it will, I saw one that said, your church is covered for sexual misconduct for all acts committed by employees who have been properly trained, screened, and are acting within the policy. How many acts of misconduct are going to occur from people who are acting within the policy? Unless you have a policy that says it's okay to abuse children, anybody who abuses children is acting outside of the policy, which means you've got no coverage. So please check that. It is heartbreaking for me when I get a call from a pastor reporting a possible instance of sexual misconduct. And I always say, okay, first place you call if you haven't done so already is you hotline it. Second thing you do is make sure your DS knows. Third, immediately call your insurance company. And it's heartbreaking when I get a call back that says, we have no coverage. That church might as well close. It will not survive it. So please make sure you've got that. Surprisingly, one of the fastest growing areas of liability, and if you check your church's insurance premiums, you'll find that percentage-wise, the fastest growing area of the premium is for professional misconduct, malpractice in the area of pastoral counseling. Now, for decades, pastors have pretty much been allowed to counsel, and it's not been a problem. You don't have to go and get any particular training to do so. It's been recognized that that's part of the pastoral responsibility. But increasingly, we're seeing pastors who do not know the difference between pastoral counseling and therapy. And they are counseling in an area that they are not qualified to do so. And I've seen some pretty horrific situations where pedophiles were being counseled by people who had had one semester of pastoral counseling in seminary. And they think that that's sufficient, and it doesn't do a service to that individual, certainly doesn't do a service to the church as a whole. So we're seeing that that's an increasing area of liability. The new manual that came out 3 years ago addresses that in paragraph 536.14. The old section on pastoral counseling was pretty brief. It said, whatever is told to a pastor in the course of pastoral counseling, you take to the grave, can never be disclosed, ever. Well, I helped rewrite this, and the first thing that they tell us in law school is don't use one word where 10 will suffice. So that one sentence got replaced by a full page, and it says essentially that, well, there is an exception to that pastoral privilege, and that is in cases of child abuse that has to be reported. And then it says whenever possible and as soon as possible, a person who is being counseled needs to be informed of the following, and it gives some guidance there. Now, I recognize, and if you're a pastor, you know that most of the pastoral counseling situations, you don't have advance word. It's not where somebody calls up and says, I would like to meet with you at 3 o'clock on Wednesday to discuss an issue of pastoral counseling. Instead, it's as they're shaking your hand out of the way of the sanctuary, and they say, this has just happened in my life. And so you don't have a chance to then whip out a form and have them sign and go over all of that. I understand it. That's why it says as soon as possible, and whenever practical, you need to advise them. But if you do any kind of pastoral counseling, I'd encourage you to review that paragraph 536.14. And let's see. I guess one last issue in the time that we have remaining is unrelated business income. A lot of churches are looking for ways to get some additional revenue. Sometimes it's by having a yard sale. Sometimes it's by renting out an empty parsonage. Sometimes it's by opening up the facilities during the week for other groups to come in. There's some things that you need to be aware. As a nonprofit organization, it's not automatically illegal to have money come in a form like that, but you do need to make sure that it's reported properly, and you need to be aware of the consequences. First thing you need to know is if your church is exempt from real estate tax, you probably have an obligation to report to the county or township, whichever one is responsible for assessing that. You need to let them know if there's any regular for-profit use of your facilities going on. So if you're renting out a parsonage and it's to somebody who doesn't have a ministerial responsibility within your church, you're probably going to lose your property tax exemption on that, and you need to let the county or the township know that that's going on so they can assess it properly. If you're renting out a portion of your facilities on a regular basis, you may lose a portion of your tax exemption depending on the nature of that. It would be a good idea to talk to the taxing authorities before you enter into that relationship so that you know what the outcome is going to be. You may decide that you just don't want to go there. Then in terms of federal tax, unrelated business income is any time a nonprofit is engaged in regular business for profit. That seems rather simple, but it's from the IRS, so it obviously is not. What does regular mean? I don't know. Nobody knows. Does that mean once a month? Once a year? I don't know. But as a general rule, the closer it gets to 20% of the overall financial picture of the organization being related to that, the more likely it is that you are going to be viewed as no longer a nonprofit organization. So if your church opens up a community center and starts charging people to come in to play basketball and go swimming and so forth, there's a very good chance that you could lose your nonprofit status for the entire church if you get up to that magic number. But even if you don't get up to 20%, you do have to report it. And income that comes in from unrelated business income, you pay your usual taxes on that as if you were a for-profit corporation. If you don't do this, government gets real nasty on this. They start closing things down, seizing property, and all of that.
So can that be something as simple as when the youth do a car wash?
Probably not, unless you've got a really sophisticated
thing. Is a little different than charging somebody to use your facility. Okay.
Generally, think of it as a trade or business. So I'm familiar with one church that actually was running a hair salon, and they made it available at no cost for low-income people, but they charged the regular rate for people who weren't low-income. That was a trade or business, and they had to report that and pay tax on it.
If you've got a coffee shop or those kind of things.
A coffee shop, if it's, that starts to get hazy. If it's donation only,
okay.
And in order for something to be donation only, it means that if I come in there and I give you nothing, that I'm still entitled to get as much as if I gave you $1,000. Then you're probably going to be okay.
Because sometimes we have food pantries and people give money to that, but you don't require.
Not a problem there.